You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast, episode 254. Now, we have a very special guest with us for this show, Derm, and I have to admit, I am really looking forward to what he has to say because it's certainly an area that I'm really interested in.
Yeah, it's such great timing. And yeah, as you say, just for all of us, in, I guess the bit that I'm looking forward to, Nicole, is it isn't just applicable to being on a horse or being about to go into a competition. You know, this, you know, understanding how to think and the ability to think is actually something that has really helped from a business point of view, from a well-being outside of business, outside of horses for me. So really general applicability, and they're the podcasts I love.
Yeah, and I really hope, listeners, that you will get something out of this, whether it be for your day-to-day life, whether it be competing, training, anything. So without further ado, let us welcome our very special guest. He is a world-renowned sports psychologist. He's a trainer, a coach, an author. The list could go on. Years of experience working from everybody from the amateur rider all the way through to high-performance teams at the Olympics. Welcome to the show, Daniel Stewart.
Thank you very much for having me. Boy, that's a wonderful introduction. I have a lot to live up to, don't I?
No pressure, Daniel. Obviously, we're in a fairly slightly different situation at the moment with coronavirus and everything that's going on in the world. We're going to come on to that a little bit later because I think that's really important that we do talk about it. But first, I actually wanted to ask you, what is sports psychology? It's a term we hear a lot, but just break it down for us.
You know what? It's an interesting question. There's I suppose there are two different disciplines of sports psychology. I think what most people consider when they think of sports psychology is what is called clinical sports psychology. That's where, for example, a gymnast who has an eating disorder, they can go see a clinical sports psychologist and they can do wonders for helping that individual. However, the area of sports psychology and mental coaching that I focus on is educational sports psychology. And just very simply stated, that's helping good athletes become great athletes. You know, how to help all of them cope with challenges, overcome mistakes, eliminate perfectionism and those sort of things that hold us back. So educational sports psychology, in my opinion, is probably the most important because it's something that can help everybody become a little bit better. I've always said that we shouldn't have to believe that we need to be 100% better every day. Perhaps we just need to be 1% better every day for the next 100 days. And that's the role of educational sports psychology, teaching all of us how we can turn good into great.
I think that's really interesting, actually, because quite often, certainly when you first think about it, you quite often think of sports psychology. And, you know, a number of top riders have spoken about the ways in which they've used it and it's really helped them and helped their performance and deal with the big occasion. But actually, this is applicable to everybody in every walk of life doing every little thing. You don't have to be an elite athlete to benefit from this and the things that we're going to talk about.
Not at all. And I liked how Dan opened up the program also. This doesn't necessarily need to be just about, about equestrians. Obviously, high-performance equestrians, they have a particular set of challenges that they need to learn to cope with. But I've always said that, you know, that young up-and-downers, little peanuts, little kids that are going from a pony to a horse or from a trot to a canter, they also have their own set of challenges. And if we can cope with those challenges and if we can succeed in overcoming those challenges, then the door to success opens. Whatever our definition of success is, if that definition is colors of ribbons or steps on podiums or just joy and happiness, whatever our definition of success is, we certainly do improve the chance of creating that success if we address riding with confidence and courage. If we avoid comparing ourselves to others, if we recover quickly after making mistakes and avoid defining ourselves as a failure simply because we failed. If we can learn a couple quick little tips on how to achieve those goals of being happy and of being confident. If we can do that, then we become better riders. But I think it's also important to understand that all of us deal with challenges in our everyday lives as well. I believe that confidence and courage helps us to create stronger relationships, become stronger students in school, to become more capable employers or employees. So I really look forward to sharing, you know, a couple little tips that can help high-performance riders to become more successful competitors, to perhaps help a couple of young riders to figure out how to go from a pony to a horse with courage, and then also perhaps how to help moms and dads and brothers and sisters become, you know, more positive in their daily lives as well.
One of the things, Daniel, from our side, so our business at EquiRidings, a lot of it, you know, would use certainly similar tools. You know, we talk about marginal gains a lot. We talk about understanding the objective, you know, before you begin that journey and being very clear on it. And something that just interested me from what you were saying was whatever success means to you, there is ways and tools in which we can support you on your journey to that. Certainly one of the things that we found when we're assessing performance with riders, and again it goes from grassroots right up to our Olympic athletes, is that actually setting understanding the objective or what success is probably one of the most difficult pieces of the puzzle. And without that in mind, it can be very difficult to map out a way there. How big a part of your maybe initial work with a team or with an individual would be around helping people assess what success is in each case?
Great question. Without a definition of success, then success is really difficult to achieve. It's a little bit like having a desire to go somewhere, but not having a map to get there. I really like Starbucks, but I need my GPS to tell me how to get there. Without the GPS, without the map, the directions, it's almost impossible for us to ever believe that we're in control of success. You know, it's interesting when we talk about outcomes versus, you know, the process, and it's a little bit, you know, like it's the journey, not the destination. And I'm not going to hit, you know, that over the head too much, because we've all heard that before. But when it comes to creating desirable outcomes, I suppose, if we're going to teach ourselves to focus, you know, on the definition of success, one thing that stands between almost everybody and the avoiding of setting inappropriate goals or focusing on outcomes, one thing that interferes with most people's ability to do that is something called outgrouping. And it's a really important subject that we all need to talk about, because it's a pretty bad thing and we all do it because we don't really know that we're doing it. But if we can become mindful that we're participating in outgrouping, then we can eliminate it. And that can help us to focus more on the process of achieving success rather than what our definition of the outcome of success is. So what is outgrouping? Outgrouping is just very simply what I've always defined as wonder, wish, and worry about other people, about what other people think. So outgrouping has a lot to do with the color of a ribbon. My goal is to win a blue ribbon or a red ribbon. My goal is to finish on the top of the podium. And to do that, I need to compare myself to others. The only problem is that I am in no control whatsoever of the performance of others. So therefore, focusing on the color of the ribbon is not necessarily an admirable goal, because I'm not really in control of the color of that ribbon, because I can't control my opponents and competitors. So outgrouping is when we worry about other people. And it comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes. It comes in trying to live up to the expectations of family members. It comes in the form of comparing yourselves to riders that have gone on course before you, riders that have ridden this particular horse before you. When we wonder, wish, and worry about others, including worrying about what judges are thinking about us, how they're scoring us, what they are, what flaws they're finding in us, all of those are components of what is called outgrouping, where we We spend our time thinking about other people. And when we think about other people, we take our focus away from ourselves. So a really big focus in a lot of my teaching is instructing and showing equestrians how they can focus more entirely on themselves, on their performance, on their effort, on their recovery after mistakes, on their learning through failure. If we can focus more entirely on ourselves and steer our focus away from wonder and wishing and worrying about other people, I wonder what they're thinking. I wish they weren't watching. I worry what they're saying about me. If we can shift our focus away from outgrouping, from wonder, wish, and worry, then we can focus our attention more entirely on our performance. You know, what did I learn? What did I achieve? If we can lose outgrouping, we can focus on more correct definitions of success.
I think that's fascinating. And it's, you know, we see that replicated all of the time, again, with our high performance teams, which would be, you know, clients that we're working with all of the time. Almost all of our clients have the same objective, usually based on funding. And when we sit down with everybody, what is your objective? The first response is to win a medal. And, you know, you're alluding to it in the exact same way with the ribbons concept. It's the exact same whether you're at training level or whether you're at, you know, managing an Olympic team. Winning a medal is entirely outside of your control because it is fully dependent on other people. So what our role from a data point of view, and it's really interesting then to hear the psychology side around outgrouping, is actually from a data point of view, we say, okay, well, what we can tell you is that these are the types of scores which have won medals previously. And now, rather than saying, I want to win a medal, we try to encourage people to say, okay, well, can we deliver three scores below a score of 33? So one might do a 25 and finish on it. Someone else might finish on a 35 and finish on it. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is improve our chance of winning rather than, you know, trying to say we're going to win a medal. All we can actually control is our chance. We can't control anything other than our chance of winning a medal or winning a ribbon or achieving that success. So from a data point of view, we've been on the exact same message for some time, probably without the understanding necessarily of wonder, wish, and worry, that actually you must focus to achieve a goal, you must focus on things within your control. And part of our job in helping people set objectives using data is to be able to say, here are things you can control.
Sorry, can I ask, Daniel, both of those points are so interesting. And from my perspective, I'm thinking that sounds so easy, but actually it's harder than you think it is sometimes, because all of those things become all consuming. So how do you detach them? How do you sort of take a step back and actually focus on those things that you can control and take back control yourself to help improve your performance that way?
It's an even bigger question than your listeners are understanding, because in sports psychology, control is, well, I mean, it's everything. Our brains are designed to always seek control. That's why we develop a fear of heights, for example, is because when we develop that, when we walk close to a cliff, the brain believes that we're giving up control. The brain doesn't like that very much. The brain is always seeking control. And that's our job. Our job as coaches is to empower our riders to believe that they are in control of something. But see, here's the problem. In general sports psychology, that's usually easy dots to connect. However, when you add in the unpredictable nature of the horse, then all of a sudden our perception of control gets convoluted because riders can do everything right and it can still go wrong. A basketball player can do everything right and that ball will go through the hoop because they've done the technique and they did what they needed to do. The ball, as it travels towards the net, it doesn't spook. It doesn't miss a lead and it doesn't lose its hindquarters. It slips around the corner in wet turf. The unpredictable nature of equestrian sports creates a completely different skill set or requirement of skill sets for our athletes. I've always said that I've never seen a skier have to yell at his ski because it spooked at snow, and there's no such thing as a chestnut mare tennis racket that freaks out at the ball just before you hit it. Our brains are constantly in search of the perception of control, yet our horses constantly come up with different ways of reminding us that you're not in complete control, that you can do everything right, and it's still going to go wrong from time to time. And if we are okay with that, if we're okay with being perfectly imperfect or having perfectly imperfect performances, then we'll be all right. We'll be able to stay focused on recovery rather than focus on the problem itself. And then Dan alluded to something interesting. Instead of focusing on the outcome, the color of the ribbon or the position on a podium, instead of focusing on the outcome, we focus on the process that is required to create the successful outcome. And then your example of you know, competing in three events under a particular score is intelligent, because numerical goals are really satisfying and quite motivating. So perhaps if we could all arm ourselves with one or two or perhaps three numerical goals. Now, numerical goals are always focused on the process, rather with the exception of saying, my goal is to finish in first place, no worse than third place. Those are obviously inappropriate numerical goals. But you know, the example Dan gave, I thought, was brilliant.
In terms of goal setting, if somebody is looking to kind of they don't know whether they want a big goal or small goal, what would you advise them to do? Is it something that you can achieve in the short term? Is it something that actually should be a major, major target in the future? How would you sort of advise them in terms of being the most positive to get to that point? Is that dependent on what kind of character you are yourself?
It'll always depend on what kind of character we are, our attitudes and our sort of instinctual behaviors. They're going to influence our ability to move towards goals. However, I suppose one of the best things that we can do is we can define our goals as if it were based on a ladder, you know, going for our goals one step at a time, bite-sized pieces. Oftentimes, riders will fail to, you know, take into consideration that goals are a process, that they simply, need to be addressed one step at a time. And one of the most important goals that people oftentimes forget are something called immediate goals. Most of us are familiar with short and long-term goals, and we'll talk about those briefly. But an immediate goal is a goal that we can set and achieve today, like right now. Let me give you a good example. Let's say that one of your listeners' goals is to learn to do a flying change of lead. But they really want to do that. They want to achieve that goal. It means a lot to them. But unfortunately, that rider is currently only trotting. Now, they've seen somebody do a flying change of lead. They thought it was really cool, and they want to be able to do that. Now, obviously, it's not going to be possible for that current rider to do that current skill. So an immediate goal would be to watch a video this afternoon or to read a chapter in a book on the flying change of lead. See, that's a goal they can set today and achieve today. They're in complete control of that goal because they actually have a YouTube account or they have a book on equestrian where it's going to cover flying changes of lead. An immediate goal is what I've always considered the spark that lights the fire that gets us excited to achieve something. So I really encourage riders to identify an immediate goal. And the definition, a goal they have to be able to accomplish and achieve today, by the end of the day, by midnight tonight. Now we can go beyond the immediate goal. Once they've watched a YouTube video on how to do a flying change of lead, then they need to start to move up that ladder. The first rung of the ladder is the immediate goal. Second rung of the ladder would be the start of three or four different short-term goals. First short-term goal, learn how to canter. Second short-term goal, learn how to canter on purpose. The next short-term goal would be learn how to canter on the left and the right equally balanced. Another short-term goal would be to learn how to do a simple change of lead with a trot connection. Another short-term goal would be learn how to do a simple change of lead with a walk transition. And then as you go up that ladder, then you finally reach the top rung of the ladder, which is learn how to do a flying change of lead. So I think oftentimes the temptation of achieving goals is so strong that we forget to step one step at a time. We try and jump and jump and jump from where we are to the top of the ladder, but unfortunately, we're not that good at jumping. And the more we jump and fail, the greater chance we have of perhaps believing that we're not capable of achieving that goal, we're not good enough to achieve that goal. And the problem is, yes, we are capable to achieve it. We're just good enough to achieve it. We've just forgotten that we can't jump from the bottom to the top. We need to take it one step at a time. But I do believe that the immediate goal is the spark that most people forget to get themselves excited.
I think that's really important. Actually, you just talking about that has kind of reminded me of something that I do in daily life. I'm a big list writer. And quite often I have one, like a big job that I need to do. But actually, if I just put that big job down, it feels very overwhelming. So I often write it down in like really, really small bits so that I feel like when I tick something off, I've achieved something and then I move on to the next bit. And actually, it's the same objective. I'm still getting to the final part of it. It's just more incremental rather than one big jump. So if obviously people have got their goals set and they've got a target, they've got their aims, they know what they want to achieve, how can we give them some tools to help them get there? So say somebody gets really nervous or they get anxious about stepping up a level or even just, you know, smaller things. People get very nervous going into competition. Give them some tools that they can put that into practice at home, whether they're training, whether, I mean, at the moment it will be training, but then down the line competing as well.
All right, great. So you know what? And I think that your listeners will actually enjoy this little program I'm going to introduce right now. It's a program that I call How Not to Get to Thank You Yet. and they're not supposed to understand that. How Not to Get to Thank You Yet is actually five different mini tips and tricks or techniques that can help all of us become a little bit more confident, overcome show jitters, performance anxiety, and focus on ourselves, focus on what we can do to succeed. It's so easy for us to get trapped in focusing on the negative. There's something called a scarcity mindset, where we tell ourselves what we are not good at, what we do not have, why we don't measure up. What we're incapable of achieving. That's a scarcity mindset, telling ourselves what we don't have. The opposite of that is the abundance mindset, where we remind ourselves of what we do have, what skills we are capable of achieving, what effort we are capable of putting forth. So in order for us to shift the mindset from scarcity to abundance, we need some sort of scaffolding, some sort of tricks and techniques that we can use to do that. So the five tricks that I'll introduce right now, how not to get a thank you yet. The first tip revolves around the word how. All right. What we've discovered is that we are much better at achieving successful outcomes when we tell ourselves how to do it rather than telling ourselves to do it. So here's a good example. I can tell a rider, don't be nervous, quit freaking out. I can tell them that, and it's probably really good advice because they're freaking out right now, but it is not going to be successful because I'm telling them what to do. My goal to achieve that that behavior, instead of telling them what to do, should encourage them to tell them how to achieve it. So instead of saying to myself, quit freaking out, stop being so nervous. If I were to say that, I'm in trouble. But if I ask myself how to stop being nervous or how to quit freaking out, then I create a productive plan. So it would sound like this. Danny, quit freaking out. Negative. The positive would be, all right, Danny, I'm nervous. What do I need to do to calm down? How can I calm down? Okay, I can calm down by taking a deep breath, remembering an instance when I rode well in this venue, and listening to music. Okay, I'm going to plug my music in right now. I'm going to take a deep breath and I'm going to visualize a memory from my past that was empowering. Instead of me telling myself what to do, I ask myself how to do it. And when you develop that how-to plan, it creates the potential to move towards it. It's a little bit like when we all wake up in the morning. I can say to myself, I've got so much to do. Or I can say to myself, okay, how do I need to build my plan for the day? Just like you mentioned with your taking notes. So the first part of the how not to get to thank you is I encourage all of your listeners to begin to ask themselves, how do they achieve behaviors like relaxing rather than telling themselves to relax? Let's move through this, this technique, how not to get to thank you. How was the first one? The second technique is called not to. not to. So our brain responds much better when we tell ourselves what to do rather than telling it what not to do. For example, if somebody is afraid of heights and I tell them, do not look down, we all know that they will have some sort of
look
innate
down.
Desire to want to look down.
You always want
if
to look down,
if somebody is nervous, yeah. If I identify a rider who's nervous and I say, do not be nervous, it just makes them more nervous. So we want to avoid the word not, meaning we want to direct our self-directed questions away from the negative towards the positive. So instead of saying, do not look down, what do we say? We say, keep your eyes up. Instead of saying, do not be nervous, I say, take a deep breath and relax. So I encourage all of your listeners to listen to the words that they say to each other and to always make an effort to direct their intentions towards the positive rather than towards the negative. Why are you always so nervous? Everybody is better than me. Learn to direct our self-directed thoughts in towards the positive. How not to? So let's ask ourselves how to achieve things. Let's avoid saying the word not. I will not be nervous. I will not look down. Avoid the word not. The third part of the how not to get to thank you yet is the get to part. Get to. There are two words that they say that we say on average 25,000 times a year, and those two words get us into a lot of trouble. Those two words are have to. So listen carefully. I have to get out of bed early because I have to go to the bar because I have to work on my transitions because I have to go to the horse show this weekend. See, the problem with the word have to is when we use those words, the brain believes that it is no longer in complete control because it has to do something. It must do it. I have to do this. Now, if we can remove the words have to and replace them with more positive substitutions, then the brain starts to create a greater perception of control. So let's take that conversation and change it. Here's the new conversation. I want to get out of bed early because I get to go to the barn, because I love it working on transitions, because I'm going to the horse show. Can you hear the difference in that conversation? When I told myself, I have to get out of bed, I have to go to the barn, I have to work on my transitions, the subconscious believes I am not in control because I have to do it. I am obliged to do it. See, our life is full of obligations, but when we use the word, or our life is full of opportunities, but when we use the word have to, it turns those opportunities into obligations. So the third thing that I really encourage your listeners to do is to identify, do they have the tendency to say, I have to do this, I need to do this. And when they hear themselves thinking those words, replace the have to's and need to's with the going to, want to, like to, and love to's. And it changes the actual perception of our daily lives. And it shines that light towards opportunity rather than obligation.
That's good, isn't it, Nicole? Nicole, will you give me an example there? Just so I'm going to get you into this positive frame of mind. Just because, the way you have to, I would say you have to edit quite a lot of pods and you have to look after Ravy Toby. And actually, we have the opportunity to start,
you're catching yourself right. There, aren't you?
We actually do it all the time, don't we?
I think it's really important, actually, that this is everyday life. So this will absolutely apply to your training, to competing, that you have to go to a show and therefore you have to do something. And actually, going to a show is meant to be fun. Like, if you really don't want to go, you don't have to go. Nobody's telling you have to. So actually breaking it down and thinking about what we're saying. I already, when you were saying that you have to do this, you have to do that, I was thinking personally, even just listening to that was making me quite stressed because I was thinking, God, I've got all this to do. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to do the other. And
I
actually,
knew that would happen to you.
I know that's not even me saying that. And I was getting stressed on your behalf. So I think it's a really important lesson to learn that we actually just have to take a moment to think about how we're saying things. And
we can just take a moment, Nicole, to listen.
Yeah,
to how
sorry. We must do it. No, but we can take a moment and we have that power to do that. And if we can restructure, and I suppose the more we do it and the more we actually pay attention to doing it, the more natural it will become. So you can almost change your mindset by making it more of a good habit that you constantly think of things in a good way. I'm going to be really aware of how many times I have to do.
Is that Daniel? Is that NLP? Is that the neuro-linguistic? Is that words, or is that something different?
Absolutely. That's where it's born from. But you know what? Another word that defines what this is, a real catchy phrase that most of us are using these days, is mindfulness. Yeah. Becoming mindful of the dialogue that we have with ourselves. Many of us are pretty mindful of the dialogue we have with others. Many of us, well, it's been proven, we believe in others more than we believe in ourselves. And most often, we treat others better than we treat ourselves. But that comes down to self-dialogue, self-talk as well. Mm. Just by becoming simply mindful of the words we use. And I think that's why this kind of podcast is so important. Maybe, just maybe, one person will leave today saying, I'm going to become more mindful of the word have to, or must to, or need to. Because in fact, they do like horse showing, but it's become a bit of a burden because of the words that they use when they think about horse showing. So, you know what this is? This is a skill. Mindset is a skill. It's a skill. Every bit is, it's a skill similar to a flying change of lead, a release. It's a skill similar to the jumping position. It's just a skill. And the more we practice it, the better we get at it. We just need to know what skills are admirable and are profitable and productive, and practice those skills.
And a skill is something which can be developed. So you're not, different because you're not there now. It's not just that some people are positive or some people have a different outlook on life and I don't. As you say, a skill is something that we can start learning from today.
Right. And you know, the good news for young riders is they're pretty plastic. You know, when we talk about neurogenesis or, you know, neuroplasticity, they have proven, and most of us have heard of it. It's been proven now we can change our thought and behavior patterns. It's not easy, but then again, most skills that are worth having are not easy. We just are oftentimes misled into believing that skills are physical. And in fact, they're not. I believe that some of the most important skills are mental.
It comes back to that mental fitness that you talk about, in so much as we're all very aware of physical fitness and being fit and healthy, but actually a healthy mind is just as important. And actually sometimes it's good to give that mind some different exercises to keep it healthy and to keep it that way.
Yeah, we need to get to thank you. I'm nearly there.
You're ready for thank you.
I'm writing.
He's nearly there. Go on. Go for the next. Yes, definitely.
All right. So the next one is thank you. The last study I read said that we say the word thank you on average 5,000 times a year to other people, yet we never ever say it to ourselves. So this is interesting. Many of us struggle with mistakes and failures. I think that goes without saying, and I think I'm okay with that. Most of us do struggle with that. However, if we can change the perception of mistakes and failure, then we can change what those events mean to us. But how do we change the perception of mistakes and failure? We get into the habit of thanking ourselves for making mistakes. I know this is mind-blowing. I know it's, but to actually thank ourselves for making mistakes. See, there's something called error-based learning, and we all know this. Our very best learning opportunities immediately occur after making mistakes. I've always said that if we're not making enough mistakes, we're simply not trying hard enough. And also, I've always said that your last mistake is your best teacher, but you simply cannot learn from your teacher if you're not willing to go to school or listen to her when you get there. See, our mistakes are our teachers, but so many people believe that mistakes simply mean they're bad, they're not good enough, they're not like anybody else. It's wrong. The reason that we make mistakes and the reason that we fail is because whatever's going on right now, it's outside our comfort zone. Perhaps my favorite quote of all time is equestrians don't make mistakes. Mistakes make equestrians. They make us bigger and braver and bolder and brighter. But we have to develop the mental skill of understanding what the pure message is behind failure and mistakes. We are not a failure because we fail. We are not a mistake because a mistake was made. A mistake is a learning opportunity. And one way for us to change the perception, the definition of a mistake and failure, is to begin to thank ourselves for them. Thank you. Wow. Dang it. You're on the ground looking up at your horse. Well, thank you. What did I learn?
I mean, that said three gritted teeth, Daniel, to be honest.
Yeah. And this is I imagine it's still a little confusing. So let me give you a really neat example. My son came home the other day and he says, Papa, I got 89% on my calculus exam. And I said, that's a great score. Congratulations. He said, yeah, but Papa, the problem is my teacher doesn't give us the test back. I don't know which questions I got wrong. Now, if Luca could get the test back, he would have a much better chance of understanding where his mistakes were made, and therefore he'd have a better chance of understanding the actual concepts. So you know what he would have done? He would have thanked his teacher for giving him the test back so he could learn from his mistakes. We need to do the same thing to ourselves. We need to thank ourselves for getting that paper back so that we understand where the mistakes were made so that we can understand how we can improve upon them. So the fourth part of this program is to, believe it or not, thank yourself for making mistakes, because it's the understanding, the awareness of the mistake, the ability to own it, not blame it away, to own it, understand it, and fix it, that takes us from good to great, that helps us to move up that ladder of goals, that helps us to achieve whatever definition of success that we've created.
Just when you said that we on average thank other people 5,000 times a year, I am the biggest. I will move out of somebody's way and then thank them for it. I moved out of their way. They didn't move out of my way. And that's very much how my mind works. And actually, just listening to you there, I never thank myself for anything, whether it be mistakes or otherwise. And I think that's really.
But now you do blame yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a really valid point that actually we all just have to. Remember and keep in mind that actually. I'm going to stop talking. I choose to stop talking. Daniel, what is the last fifth point?
The last one's going to be really quick. You're going to love the last one. The last one is yet. Let's remind ourselves that we can't do everything. There's something called positive realism. Positive realism is just simply a mental mindset defined by, I realize that everything's not going to go my way. I realize I'm going to do everything right, and it'll still go wrong sometimes. I realize I can't be the best at everything. That's a positive realism. But the second part of that is, I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to stop striving to be my very best. So the last part of the technique, the yet part, is I can't do it yet. And by simply adding the word yet, it creates almost, even when I say it, it creates this temptation to start to design a plan to help me move towards what I cannot currently achieve, because I can't achieve it yet. The problem is so many of us forget the word yet. It's a three-letter word that becomes a four-letter word when we forget it, because if we forget it, it changes the meaning. I cannot do this. I cannot do this yet. And when we add the word yet, it creates that belief that there is a second chapter that we haven't gotten to yet, that there is an understanding that we might not have right now, but we can develop.
Yeah.
I think that really.
Yeah, I love that.
So it's a simple one. So how not to get to thank you yet? Ask yourself how to achieve things rather than telling yourself what to achieve. Focus on things that you can do, not on the things that you cannot do. Tell yourself that you get to do things rather than you have to do things or must do things or need to do things. Thank yourself for making mistakes and for failing. They're what define our resiliency and our grit and our strength. And then understand that you cannot do everything yet.
Always with the yes on
great.
The end.
How not to get to thank you yet. I love that, Daniel. Thank you for sharing that. I think there's even to be able to take one or two things away, which I think we're going to have fun with, Nicole, on this show in future with our language choices.
Daniel said, don't do this.
Exactly. No, I love it because actually it brings a lot of validity to things we've been talking about and working on, probably without the understanding that you're sharing with us from your experience. I'm looking at a blog post that's written by my friend Sam Watson, who's often on this show as well, and he's talking about try, fail, learn, and how some of the top athletes in the world will absolutely talk about, riders have to make have the opportunity to make mistakes, and actually that sometimes you've got to make mistakes because that's how you learn. We're not trying to create a system or a training pattern which doesn't facilitate or allow riders to make a mistake. But what Sam talks about in his so he's an article at the moment called Learning in Sport, and one of the things he talks about is talking to the Laurent Bousquet, who is the current coach of Team Japan and formerly the French coach, a very, very experienced Olympic level equestrian coach. And one of the things that he talked to him about when they were on this concept of try, fail, learn is exactly what you were referring to around the thank you point, was that actually before you can learn, so at the try, fail, learn, before you can learn, he talks about you must accept it. And actually it's try, fail, understand and learn. And he puts in that point around you cannot get to the learning piece if you can't get to the understanding piece. And trying to
when you think about traditional 12-step programs, we've heard of those. Mm-hmm. What is the first step in every 12-step program?
Acceptance
that you're part of the acceptance. Without the acceptance, the problem, we mentioned earlier, our mistakes, our failures are our teachers, but we cannot learn from them if we're not willing to go to school. And that's just my way of saying we can't learn from mistakes if we're not willing to accept them. And the problem is that things like perfectionism and outgrouping, they make it really difficult for us to accept failures. Yes. Because we have a fear of failure. That's part of being a perfectionist. So there's a lot of layers to this. Like an onion, there's layers, and every time you peel another layer away, there's another layer, and it makes you cry a little bit more. And it's a really important conversation to have, the conversation about having what I call having faith in failure. It's a really important conversation.
I think it's part of being human, isn't it? We're all worried about failure, and we all worry about what the consequences of it will be. That probably leads us in a little way into the next point that I want to raise with you just before we finish, is that obviously the situation at the world at the moment is quite a scary place. With coronavirus, it has become much bigger than just the eventing season has been disrupted. This is a global issue whereby whole countries are going into lockdown. And actually, that is very scary. So what can we do if we're perhaps feeling anxious about the current situation, whether it be that we can't even just continue with our training program? Maybe we're worried about our family, our friends, maybe we're concerned about our job, our finances, any number of things that could be concerning people. What would be your advice to them in the current situation to help them manage?
Yeah, great. So three things. Build a ladder of goals, based on what your current desire is. Regardless of what we're going through right now, we're all going through something right now with the coronavirus. Always remember, build your how not to get to thank you yet. Build that. But the last one, this is really interesting, and it's just another mental mindset that I think when we become mindful of it, it helps us to overcome it. There's something called a telescoping bias. And a telescoping bias is just very simply this. We look at our challenges, our weaknesses, our mistakes and our failures as if looking at them through a telescope. And when you look at those things through a telescope, how do they appear? They appear larger than they actually are. They really do appear larger than actual size. So the first half of the telescoping bias is we tend to look at our shortcomings as if looking through a telescope, and it magnifies the size of them. But the other part of the telescoping bias is when we look at our strengths, our successes, our abilities, our capacities, when we look at those, we look at them as if looking through the wrong end of the telescope so that they're minimized, that they look smaller than they actually are. My advice to your listeners right now is turn the telescope around, look at your strengths, look at your abilities, look at your look at your chances, look at your opportunities right now. And coronavirus, believe it or not, it is providing all of us with opportunities. For the first time in about 8 years, my entire family went for a bike ride the other day. I played more street hockey in the last week than I've played in 3 years with my son. I'm building a puzzle with my daughter right now. I'm gardening with my wife. I get it. I get that the big picture is disrupted. I get that looking, obviously, and I understand it. Many of us have lost our jobs. It's very easy to look at that through the telescope and just to see how big that loss is. But turn it around and look at our opportunities also through that same telescope, because the opportunities we're given right now are pretty brilliant. We've been blinded to them. The telescoping bias is part of what are called blind spot biases, because like a car stuck in our blind spot, we're not aware of them, but they're dangerous. I do believe that many of us are not aware of the pace that we ask of ourselves. I read a study recently. It said 66% of people hope to get sick at some point this year so they can take a rest from the pace that of the life that they have created. Two-thirds of us want to get sick so we can slow down. Coronavirus is an opportunity to allow us to slow down. I get it. I get that the coronavirus is it's a telescope and it's magnifying our wonders, wishes, and worries. But my advice to your listeners is turn it around and look at the opportunities. The opportunities are there. They're right there. They're right in front of us. And those opportunities will make us stronger. Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, is futile and apparently idiotic. This is our opportunity to change. Most of us resist change and don't want change, but change is required and change is necessary for what I said earlier, becoming bigger, braver, bolder, and brighter. This is our opportunity to make a positive change. But to do that, we need to turn the telescope around.
I think that's really good advice, and certainly something that both Derm and I can actually take on board with our lives and the current situation as things stand at the moment as well.
The bigger, braver, bolder, and brighter. I've no doubt, Nicole, we will take that on.
I will be quoting this. Daniel, thank you so much. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the USCA official podcast. I know we've only scratched the surface, but we really do appreciate your time. And hopefully all of the listeners, I know I've certainly learned things, and I'm going to choose to take a lot of them on board. See what I did there?
Excellent.
Right now you're being something called a mirror, and mirroring is really important. When you develop a positive behavior or attitude, when other people see or experience you, then there's a greater chance of them adopting that. We are all mirrors, and people oftentimes reflect what they see in other mirrors. For example, if you want to be a good gossiper, you should hang out with people who gossip. If the two of you can develop perhaps some more positive mannerisms and behaviors in the future, and you have a wonderful audience base, then perhaps you'll be the mirror that helps them to develop positive behaviors, and in doing so, become positive mirrors to those around them. So let's start a fire with this positivity.
We absolutely
big responsibility,
can.
Nicole.
I know, no pressure. I feel pressure.
Yeah, right. No pressure.
I'm gonna have to go through it and think, oh God, I don't have to do it. I just think about
you
it
can.
Carefully.
You can.
I can do it. I absolutely can do it. And if I can't do it, then it's I can't do it yet.
Exactly. Good.
Daniel, thank you so much. Derm, thank you as well, because we have thoroughly enjoyed this insight into sports psychology. I appreciate that it is just, as I said, scratching the surface, but it has been a real joy to have you on the show. So, Daniel, thank you for coming on.
You're very welcome. It was a pure pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this. We hope that there might be a couple of bits in it that can help you and that you think, actually, I can apply that to my daily life as well. So wherever in the world you are, whatever your current situation, stay safe, look after yourselves, and we'll be back very soon with another episode of the USCA official podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the USCA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.